Looking here at the Mishnah on Daf Samach Amud Aleph, the Mishnah again continues with the laws of Honah and Gnevas Das with regard to marketing and sales. What's fair practice? What's unfair practice? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Lo Yechalik Hachenvani Kloyos Ve'egozim L'tinokos. It's a very interesting practice and very meaningful, very successful, for the owner of a store to give out small gifts to children, to young children, to attract them to the store. And Rabbi Yehuda opposes the practice of giving out kloyos. Kloyos are sort of like cereal, your dried cereal. What they used to do is take, you know, the cut down wheat or whatever grain while it was still soft, and they would put it in the oven and it would come out to be a soft kind of a kernel, and the children loved that kind of stuff. The egozim, they would give out various kinds of nuts, and these were children who were sent by their parents to buy something as a shliach, and they would probably have been sent to a different store, but because of the practice of this particular store owner, and he may not even be giving the right price and the right quality, but the children gravitate towards that store. They show margilam lovo etzlo. He definitely makes them attracted to his store. Almost with a gravitational pull, they become almost addicted to buy in his store. And one of the super commentaries on Shulchan Aruch Hoshim Mishpat Siman Chof Zayin, the Beis Ephraim, says that the reason why Rabbi Yehuda is opposed to this practice, even though it doesn't seem to be anything illegal about it, he's, at the end of the day, he's just giving out gifts, is because there's a certain element of Ramos here. He wants to get the children to buy in his store when their parents may have sent them to a different store. And he's taking advantage of the parents, really. And we'll soon see that there's an issue. This doesn't appear right here in Bava Metzia, but later on in Bava Basra, about a ben mavui opening up a competing practice. Let's say, for example, you live in my mavui. Mavui is like a cul-de-sac in my neighborhood, and you own a barbershop. Am I allowed to open up a competing barbershop? So, according to Rav Huna in Bava Basra Daf Chaf Aleph, that's permissible. You know, we're free enterprise. I can compete with you by opening up another store, and hopefully I'll do a better job than you, and the clients will come to me then and choose me over you. But if Rav Huna allows that, the Beis Ephraim says he would still have room for accepting Rabbi Yehuda in our mission, because in this case, although we permit free competition, but nevertheless, this has an element of, as we said before, deception in it, insofar as the children were sent to other stores and not to this store, but he's sort of he's winning them over to come to his store. The Chachamim in our Mishnah say, Matirin, they say it's permissible. There's nothing illegal about it. Unless he's really either undercharging or overcharging the children when he sells them whatever he sells them. But assuming he offers them merchandise at a fair price, then even though he magnetically pulled them towards his store, that's not illegal. And the Gemara is going to embellish this in just a few minutes. We'll get to it. The Mishnah continues and says, Lo yifchos es hashar, that according to the Tanakhama, it is forbidden to sell at a sale price, to slash one's price. There's a given and well-known price for that particular item that he's selling, and other sellers offer that price. He tries to undercut them by selling the same merchandise at a lower price, and that's unfair because he's going to cut into the parnasa, to the mizonos, as we call it, of his friends, of his colleagues who are selling the same category of merchandise. The Chachamim say, Zochel Atov, not only is it permissible, but I would even give him a Yashikoyach here, give a blessing for this, because what he's going to do is he's going to break the market price. In other words, if he lowers the price, then others will also have to sell cheap. And why is that a good thing? And why is that Zochel Atov? The reason for that is because what used to happen is, and this was quite standard, in, let's say, the summer season when certain fruits are in abundance in the market, a seller is tempted to take some of that produce and put it into deep freeze, and he'll sell it in the winter when all of his competitors are completely out of that fruit. And that's how he's going to win over the market. And what's going to happen is, because he's selling a rare fruit at that time of the year, in other words, he's selling berries in the winter, then he's going to jack up his price, and the public is going to suffer if they want to get access to those fruits. You know, I come from New York originally, and there, you know, you can almost get any fruit at any time of the year. There's so much merchandise that's being imported and exported, and the United States is a big country. But here in Israel, for example, we have certain seasonal fruits, and in other seasons, it's virtually impossible to get a hold of them. And a smart businessman will hold on to his merchandise during the abundant season, and instead of selling it, he'll offer it later on when it's rare in the market at a higher price. And ultimately, people are paying a ridiculously unfair high price. So that if this gentleman described in the Mishnah, who's poches es hashar, he offers a lower price, which is a fair price, then the Chachamim say Zochel Atov. That's a great thing that he's doing. He's doing a service for the public. The Mishnah continues with another machlokas. Lo yavar es hagrisim divrei abashol. Now, we're talking about brera. Brera means when you take out the psolas from the ochel, you take out the part that's not meant to be eaten. Now, the truth is, these grisim, which are certain kinds of pulim, meaning beans, can be sold even with the chaff on top of them, that surrounds them. People will buy them, and the buyer will go through the effort and the hassle, if you will, of removing the chaff. This very smart seller decides that he's going to offer a service, and he's going to remove the shell and sell pure grease, and selling a higher quality merchandise relative to the market, because he saved the buyer the hassle of going through this kind of thing. And l'chora, what's unfair about this particular kind of business practice? And the answer is, he's going to overcharge, and it's a form of onah vis-a-vis the seller, vis-a-vis the buyer, because the buyer is so impressed that these grisim look so beautiful, he's going to be willing to add to the price, to the going rate, more than what the increment that he's going to pay is more than commensurate to the amount of work to produce this superior quality greasing. The Chachamim matirim, the Chachamim say it's okay. The Gemara is going to explain that. According to the Chachamim, let the buyer figure out what he's willing to pay extra, how much it's worth it to him, to add something to the price in order to save himself this hassle. And a smart buyer will understand that if, let's say, the item is normally sold for 10, it's worth another 2 because it was peeled, he'll be willing to pay 12. But if the seller has jacked up the price to 15, then he, this buyer, doesn't want to get ripped off. Umodim, however, there is a situation in which the Chacham agree it's deceptive. Shelo yavar me'al pi megura. What he might do is, the seller, he might remove the chaff from the top layer of grisim, that which is visible to the eye of the buyer, and leave the rest, the remainder, the balance of the 2, which is below the top level and it hidden, concealed from the eye, with its psolus on it. She'eno el kigonev es ha'ayin. Because in this case, the Chacham agree this is deceptive. What he's trying to do is fool the buyer into thinking that what he's getting is the same, is uniform throughout the entire bag that he's selling him, the whole box, when in truth it's only the top layer. It's like, you know, sometimes you buy strawberries and the strawberries on top of the box, which are, you know, can be seen through the transparent wrap around them, are in perfect shape. Then you get home, and lo and behold, you open up the box of strawberries, and the rest of the strawberries on the bottom, or at least some of them, are full of mold, or, you know, they've grown beards, white beards and stuff, you know, so that you fool the seller, I'm sorry, the seller fools the buyer, by removing the chaff and showing a high quality produce on the top, when in the low levels, the low layers, he hasn't touched them. That for sure is prohibited. What else is considered deceptive? The Mishnah says, and it would seem that nobody disagrees with this statement, Ein mefarkasin lo es ha'adam lo es ha'beim lo es ha'kelim. Mefarkasin means when you beautify something. You know, you spitz it up, so to speak. Wolf verspitzt, wolf verputzt. And you deceive the seller, the buyer again, into thinking he's getting something new, something beautiful, when in truth it's used in old goods. You know, in the car market, automobile industry, this is, especially amongst used car dealers, this is classic. They really... I don't want to be motzi laz on all car dealers, but many of them will rip you off because they don't tell you about the mechanics, you know, the inner mechanical difficulties in the engine and so forth, and how many accidents it might have been in. They're beautiful, they're wonderful at doing the body work and presenting to you what looks like a beautiful brand new car. Even though, again, they tell you it's used, but they don't tell you how old it really is. Now, the Mishnah, notice, has 3 cases of pirkus, all of which are prohibited. There's Adam, there's Behema, and there's Kalim. So let's just go through all three cases in the Mishnah. Number 1, Adam. This is a reference to an Eved Knani. When you sell an Eved Knani, it's a sale for life. The buyer is really investing in a lifelong investment because the Eved Knani is Kani Liolam. In fact, there's an Iser essay, Liolam Behem Yavodu, that enjoins the owner of the Eved Knani from freeing his Eved. In the case of an Eved Ivri or an Om Ivriya, to beautify, if the seller beautifies the Eved or the Amma, in ways that we're going to describe in just a minute, in order to attract a buyer, that's not prohibited because that's a limited kinyan. That only applies until simonim or 6 years max. And not only that, the Yisrael, the Jew who sells himself in his Eved, it's because he doesn't have enough money to support himself and he's desperate for funds. It's a mitzvah to be in a farnes of such a Jew. And therefore we want to encourage the sale, the successful sale on the market of an Eved Ivri. But in the case of an Eved Knani, that's as we said before, that's a lifelong investment, and to encourage the sale by through means of deception, that's prohibited. Now at this point, I'd like to quote a comment of the Yaivitz, that's Rav Yaakov Emden, on Rashi. Rashi says at the end of the Mishnah, Eved Knani lo es ha'odom Eved Knani ha'omed limacher, and the Yaivitz adds that in the case of what he calls a bas kiora, which means a girl who's not so attractive, says the Yaivitz, if a father wants to marry off his daughter and he's trying to find a suitor, he's allowed to make her look beautiful. He should do the best he can, the maximum effort, to beautify his daughter and find her attractive in the eyes of a potential Mekadesh. But that's only because she's not so attractive. However, says the Yaivitz, what about the following scenario? Let's say she has a mum, she has a blemish. And in Masechta Ksuvos on Daf Ayin Beis, there's a list of mumim, of different kinds of blemishes, which qualify as a mekach tos. When a man marries a woman and he finds, to his surprise, a certain kind of a very basic physical deficiency, he's out. You know, the marriage is under false pretenses. Says the Yaivitz, a girl who has one of the Nebuch has one of those blemishes, and through Pirkus, the father, or for that matter, she herself, conceals that blemish. That, he says, is Ein Lecha Ona Gedola Mizu. This mum is something that would undermine the whole Das Kiddushin of the Mekadesh and completely void the marriage. And now someone is deliberately trying to conceal such a mum. That's absolutely forbidden. And my friends, this would be relevant to Shaduchim. You know, you can't hold back on this kind of evidence, of this kind of a physical blemish, that if the person knew about it, he would be completely uninterested in the marriage. That's Ona. And the Yaivitz adds another thing, that if she or her father conceals her blemish, a blemish which generates a din of Yotzeis below Ksuba, that the marriage is dissolved and the husband, the Mekadesh, doesn't even have to pay a Ksuba, that's the sugya there in Ksubas, that would create a situation of Boshes Gedola. You mislead a man to marry a woman, and tomorrow, when he discovers the mum, the marriage is dissolved, is annulled, under the law of Mekatos, the woman goes out without a ksuba. That's a Boshes Gedola. That's very humiliating to her. So to put a woman, in this case if a person puts his daughter into that situation, which is going to lead to her humiliation, that's absolutely forbidden. He goes on to say that if a woman is older and she wants to present herself as a younger woman by coloring her hair, dyeing it a different color, that also is Ona. However, the Yaivitz sets up the following boundaries or framework. He says, what is the discrepancy between her actual true age and the age that she looks like after the Pirkus, so after the dyeing of her hair? He says, if the discrepancy is fundamental, meaning the man who we're trying to attract into this marriage is looking for a woman who could have children, and this woman is beyond the age of childbearing, and she presents herself as being that much younger, as if to say she can bear children, that, he says, is Ona Gedola. That's absolutely forbidden. He's not sure, and here he wavers back and forth, about an age difference that's within the bounds of Yecholo Lele, meaning she's not older than Yecholo Lele. She's, let's say, 35 and she can have children, but she presents herself as a 25-year-old. So here the difference is how many years does she have to bear children? And she's presenting herself in a way that she's, you know, as if to say she's 10 years younger than she really is, and she has an extra 10 years of childbearing for her future record. He's not sure if that's allowed, if that's enough, if she's crossed the red line by presenting herself as a significantly younger woman, because there's no, in this case, although the age difference is serious, is significant, but it's not a fundamental difference, because in any case, even in her actual true age, she is able to bear children. In any event, let's get back to the three cases. So we have first the case of Adam, then we have the case of Behema, then the case of Caleb. So the Ben Ish Chai and Ben Yoyodi points out here that the Mishnah wants to tell us the lesser chiddush, and then the greater chiddush, and then finally the greatest chiddush. First, the Mishnah tells us that we're enjoined from misleading someone to buy an eved by pirkus, by showing him to be yofeh when he's not yofeh, and the lokeach really loses his investment. Imagine the following scenario: the buyer purchases an eved thinking, because he was deceived into thinking so, that this is a young eved who's capable of carrying, you know, very heavy weight, and that's what he bought, and that's what he needs. And lo and behold, he gets home, he asks the eved, you know, to take out the rubbish, and the eved, with a smile on his head, he says, why are you talking to me about taking out the rubbish? I'm 20 years older than you are. I'm an alta buck. I'm an eved zaken. So basically, from the perspective of the buyer, this eved is not worth anything for him. So that's the lesser chiddush. Then we get to the greater chiddush, and that's the case of Behema. The Behema, even if it looks better than it really is, because the seller did a great job in beautifying the eved and fapputzing the eved, but nevertheless, the kona, the buyer, hasn't lost his money. The Behema is still capable of working. It looks a heck of a lot better than it really is, but the animal is worth something for the kona. Then the Mishnah presents the most extreme chiddush, and that's the case of Caleb. Caleb, once you invest in beautifying the kli, even though, let's say, it's an older kli, it's a secondhand kli, then that extra shvach to the kli by improving it and embellishing it is something that's worth, that itself has a value. In other words, the seller has really invested in beautifying this kli, and that investment really pays off in a sense. Whatever he successfully did to improve the kli, that's what we call a shvach hamiskay. That is something that's going to be maintained for the life of the kli, for the balance of the life of the kli, as long as it can last. But nevertheless, the Mishnah tells me even in that case, the pirkus is prohibited because it misleads the buyer to think he's getting a brand new shiny kli. You know, you can see the reflection of the sun in the kli, but really it's an old, used kli that was just beautified through pirkus. So pirkus is a general term that includes any sort of beautifying something in order to make it look better, significantly better, whatever that improvement is, than it really, really is. Now let's go back to the case that we began with. The sugya in the Gemara is now going to go back to the machlokas from Yehuda and Chachamim about chiluk kloyos latinokos, you know, giving out these sweets, these candies, these nuts to the children, and therefore baiting them, if you will, through this magnet against the will of the children. That's the will of parents, the way the Beis Ephraim understood it. Why are the Chachamim not impressed with the logic of Rabbi Yehuda? Why don't they get on board as seeing and defining this as deceptive. And the Gemara answers, the Chachamim's view is the Amar Lei, that this store owner can say to the other competitors, Ana Mefalgena Amzuguze. Mefalegna means the Lashon Pilug, I'm giving out, I'm separating, you know, the egoism and giving this to this child, this to the other child. I'm giving out candies. And at plague Shiski, why don't you one up me? You know, you too can offer a gift that's more, that's even more alluring, more attractive to the children. You can offer them Shiski, which is Shkedim. I mean, the different interpretations exactly what Shiski is. Rashi seems to interpret it as to be Shkedim, although elsewhere in Masechta Yuma he seems to be assuming that it's Shizifim. Shkedim are almonds, and Shizifim are prunes. But be that as it may, whatever it is, it's even more attractive to these children than Egozim. So therefore, the Rabbanan are insisting on this free enterprise, because the seller who's offering these gifts to the children has a right to say to other sellers that you can compete with me by offering even more attractive gifts to the children. That's as far as the first case in the Mishnah. Then we saw a machlokes between the Chachamim and the Tanakama about lowering the prices, slash prices, offering a sales price. The Tanakama was opposed to it, and the Chachamim allowed it. And once again, the Gemara says, "My taima derabbanan." Now, this is a little bit strange. When the Gemara has a machlokes and asks, "My taima de so and so," it means that the other opinion was much more intuitively correct. And here, you wonder why the Chachamim are on the firing line, why the Gemara is perplexed about the Chachamim. Rashi says, "My taima," at the end of the page, "Nakud zocher latov lashon bracha," meaning that, you know, it's one thing if the Chacham would have said that this is fair and permissible big business practice to cut the price and slash it, but why do they add zocher latov? And l'chora, even zocher latov seems to be pshita. I don't know why the Gemara is confused about that, because as we said earlier, the Chachamim are maintaining that it's going to have a ripple effect throughout the entire market, and if he lowers his price, then the others are going to lower their price. Therefore, he's zocher latov. And it's very fascinating to me that the Panim Hameiros derives a very radical, far-reaching conclusion based on the the attack, the premise that underlies this question, my time of the Rabbanon. He says that there's a balancing here between two poles, two extremes. On the one hand, the halach has to be sensitive to the needs of the mochrim, and by allowing one particular seller to cut his prices, that's going to undermine the parnos of the other potential competitive sellers. From the other perspective, we have to protect the interests of the buyers. And by allowing a seller to cut his prices, although that's painful for the other sellers that he competes with, but it's very beneficial for the buyers. So we have to juggle the buyers against the sellers. And the Panim Meiros says that the premise of our sugya of the Gemara here at the bottom of Daf Samach Amud Aleph is that we have to be more concerned about the livelihood of the sellers and their loss than about the price that the buyers are going to pay and suffer if they have to pay a higher price. Because in the case of the buyers, okay, there's a certain possibility that they could have gained something minimum through the sale price. But on the other hand, look what's at stake as far as the mochum is concerned. Their very parnas is at stake. If nobody buys from them their merchandise, then they have no food to put on the table and support their families. So the Gemara thinks that there has to be some justification of the Chacham allowing for a practice of one seller undermining the position of the other competitive sellers in such a way that he might run them out of business, and they're going to lose their chiyus, their parnasa, their mizonos. And here we turn to Daf Samach Amud Beis, and the Gemara answers, Mishum deka marvech lesara. And what the Gemara is answering is that by allowing this seller to cut his price, we're talking about really allowing the seller to cut his price in a way that reflects the fair market price as opposed to the exorbitant price that the other sellers are selling. Meaning, we go back to that business practice that we mentioned earlier, that the seller realizes during the winter season that he should hold on and preserve certain fruits that won't be available on the market in the summer, or vice versa, from the summer to the winter. And then what's happening is, in this practice, the buyers are going to suffer from this when the sellers jack up the price in a way that's really unfair. So basically, by allowing for slash prices, what the Chachamim are understanding, their understanding is that that's going to bring back a fair price into the market. And there's so many economic variables here that go into creating a fair market, but the allowance for sales is not going to undermine the true and genuine value of the price that ultimately is going to be offered in the shuk, in the market, but rather it's a factor that ultimately will stabilize the market and bring it to a fair price. Now we go on to the next case in the Mishnah about removing, this practice of the sellers to remove the chaff, remove the covering over the grisim, over these kernels, and Rabbi and Abba Shol opposes it. The Chachamim permit it, and the Gemara wants to see if we can identify from other sources who exactly is the Chachamim or are the Chachamim. Which Chacham are we talking about? Man Chachamim, and the Gemara answers Rabbi Acha. To Sanya, we have a brisa elsewhere which is going to establish the identity of our Chachamim as that of Rabbi Acha, because the brisa says that Rabbi Acha matir bedavar hanire. We can add la'ayin. The liberal approach to fair market, to free market, on the part of Rabbi Acha says that he is the barometer. If the seller is offering something to the buyer which the buyer could check out, it's a dovra nira la'ayin, which means that if you look at the grisim, you could clearly distinguish between those that from which the psolus was removed and those where the psolus is still there. That's something that's nira la'ayin. So the buyer could always add into this equation, what is it worth for me if the seller relieved me of that extra hassle of removing the psolus, and the buyer, if he's smart enough, he'll decide for himself what it's worth it for him to pay extra when the sale was not on regular grisim, but on grisim mevurarim. And therefore, there's no reason, says Rabbi Acha, to be worried and inhibited about allowing such a business practice, because ultimately a smart seller will be able to protect himself and he'll be able to understand with his das, by using his wisdom, as to what is a fair price and how much more the seller has a right to jack up the price as a result of the fact that he was borrowed the grisim. The Meiri writes that the reason why, according to Rav Acha, this is not considered deceptive business practice, the whole valokeach meshayer bedaitos atosef sheishal sham lagrisim burim v'lo yishalim elikafi haroi. The seller will know, says the Meiri, exactly how much he should be paying and what it's worth it for him to pay for the mevurarim. And Rashi on the top of Daf Samach Amud Beis says, hello, Yochel alokeach liros lahavin ma dme hapsoles hanivar me elu sheishna vacher v'tovu lahalos dmeim shal elu yeser alkeim ibnei Torah. Meaning that it's justified on behalf of the seller. The seller is justified to jack up his price because he put in this extra work. Then finally, we get to the last part of the Mishnah and the practice of Pirkus, which clearly is a prohibited practice universal, accepted by everyone. And the Gemara quotes a Braisa in this context. Tanur Rabbana, we learned in the Braisa, Ein Misharbitin Es HaBehema. The Braisa is going to get into three different kinds of practices that were commonly implemented by the sellers. One is with regard to a behema. They used to do something called sharbitin. What is sharbitin? Sharbit. This means zlizkof es sehera behema kisharbit. They would cause the hair of the animal to stand up like a stick. And the Gemara wants to know. Let's just read the Gemara. Why would this be deceptive? And the answer is because if the animal's hair stands up, the animal looks stout, and it really isn't. And that's, I think, what Rashi means here when he says shezokev se'era behema kisharvit v'nira shetira. Shmena. So it's really a lean kind of animal. It somehow gives the appearance of being a fat animal. V'ein nofchin b'kravayim. What does ein nofchin b'kravayim means? Nipuch l'napeach means to bloat it up, to make it look inflated. B'nei b'ayim means the kishkis of the animal, and they had a method by which they could do this. And when they sold it in the Beis HaMitbachayim, it looked like these animals were much fatter and wider than they really, really are. They look like large animals by the inflation of their intestines. And the Bryce goes on to forbid a third practice, Ein Shorin Es HaBosar B'mayim. The butchers are not allowed to take the meat and soak it in water, which makes it look whiter, and even a kachush, when it looks lavan, it looks fat. So again, these are all deceptive practices because the meat looks more desirable than it really is, and even though it's of poor quality, it looks very high quality and very fat. Then the Gemara quotes a detailed explanation about how they used to achieve these goals, these deceptive practices. My ein mesharbitin. The Gemara says, how do you do such a thing? Ketzad zokfin es se'era mehem. The Gemara answers, Hocha Targumo in Babel, they explained it. Maya dechizra, which means mashkin osa meisubin. They actually feed the animal. They feed the animal some sort of a subin, I think, would be translated as bran. And this is true even to this day, that bran is something that sort of inflates the belly. It's very hard for the small intestine to digest it, so the animal becomes bloated in this case. And Rashi says as a result of the fact of the animal being bloated, the hair actually stands up. Sa'ara nizkaf. So just feeding the animal bran, that itself is a deceptive kind of practice. And that's called maya dechizra, this kind of liquidy, branny stuff. Uzi'iri omar Rav Kahana, Ziri says the name of Rav Kahana, that mizkafta. Now in Hebrew, the word miskafta is translated as mekartzefin es sa'ara. And that, I think, could be translated as brushing the animal's hair in a way that it stands up. And this makes the animal, again, deceptively appear fat, as we said, when the hair of the animal stands up. And yet, the Gemara tells us a whole list of different practices that were implemented by various Amoraim and were apparently accepted halachically, even though it beautified the sale of a particular utensil. Shmuel Shara, he allowed Lemirma Tume Lesarbala. And in Hebrew it's Lahatil Chute Meshi Misviv Lemeil Kidei Liaposo. So Sarbala is a kind of a cloak. And what he did was he beautified the cloak by attaching on its corners various kinds of silk threads, and it really looked beautiful. But that's okay. Again, it's just a matter of selling something by making the merchandise look beautiful. There's no deception here. Rabbi Yehuda Shara Lekaskuse Krame. Lekaskuse is Leshafshef Eshabgodim. And what that means is that he allowed you to add a kind of a starching process. And this was decorative of garments. It says, L'shafs avgonim ha-mitsuyorim v'mei subin k'dei li'aposo. Again, to beautify these garments by decorating them. And Rabba Shor L'meidak Tzradei, L'medek is lahadek, to tighten. Bigde canvas. Canvas is what we call made of hemp. And b'machbeish shel eitz. And what exactly was Rava doing as a result of this? He was beating it, this kind of a hemp canvas, and that made the fibers look finer. And we said earlier in the Masechta, if you recall, that people were hired to do such a job. And that's Rava. And then Rava Sharli Salume Gire, he would actually beautify these cloths, these cloaks, by painting, in this case, Gire. Gire delay is a phrase which always refers to arrows. So he would actually beautify by painting arrows. That was his thing. That was Rava's thing. Well, I don't know when Rav had time for this. I mean, he died a very young man, Rav, and he was quite a big scholar. But Rav Papa, I mean, again, it doesn't say that Rav actually did it himself, it's just that he permitted this practice. Rav Papa Bar Shmuel Shara, he permitted Litzalume Dikule, which is Litzayer Salim Hasuyim Me'ale Dekel, which means to... These are what we call wicker baskets in English. And Shmuel and Rav Papa Bar Shmuel permitted sellers to paint up these wicker baskets. You know, I don't know why the Gemara felt compelled to actually give us this whole list and enumerate specifically what kind of ways you have to improve the Kalim. But in any event, the general rule is, and we see this common in all these four cases, is that you're allowed to do whatever you have to do to beautify the kelim. So the Gemara right now asks the obvious question for Anantanan. What about the Mishnah itself? The Mishnah says, "Ein mefarkas in los adon los abeim los akelim," that even with regard to kelim, that was the biggest chiddush, you were not permitted to be mefarkas. That was considered deceptive when you take these older kelim and make them look younger. And here, all the Amoraim, each one respectively, would permit this kind of a beautification of the, you know, by the seller of the utensils that he's selling. Lo kasha ha b'chadati ha ba'atiki. What we find that the Amoraim allowed these practices to beautify the Mekach, that's only in the case of Kelim Chadoshim. These Kelim were good and valuable in and of themselves. They were brand new, and therefore the seller knew that if he makes them look more beautiful and attractive for sale, the buyer is not going to be cheated here or deceived in any way, because it's a brand new kli. And the seller is willing to pay, you know, the extra couple of cents that the buyer is adding to the price because of the yipui, because of the extra beauty of the utensil. The buyer could buy a base, you know, a bare bones kind of utensil, or if he could buy a more beautiful decorated utensil and it's got artwork on it, and the buyer is willing to pay that extra price. There's nothing deceptive about that. There's no fundamental change it, you know, in the object, making it look like what it isn't. It's just beautifying it. But Havatiki, but in the case of older Kalim, that's the used Kalim that the Mishnah is addressing, there what the seller wants to do is to beautify it and make it look like it's new, when in truth it's used, it's old, that he's not allowed to do. The Gemara asks, Pirkus the Adam Maihi, what is the Mishnah referring to when it says, Ein Mefarchesin Esa Adam? And the Gemara tells us a story here to illustrate this. Kiha Dahu Avda Saba, there was an old Eved, an Eved Knani, as we discussed before, and his hair, the hair on his head already became white. The Azil Tsave Lereshe Uladikne, Reshi is his head, meaning the hair on his head. In this case, he dyed the hair on his head in a black color. The Dikne is his beard. Again, it would look a little funny if he had a white beard. That doesn't make him look young. So he dyed his hair on his head and he dyed his beard. Also, Lakami de Rava, and he wants to sell himself to Rava. He wants to attract Rava to buy him as an Eved. Amalei Zibnon, meaning buy me. Amalei, Rava says to him, but why should I spend my money on a non-Jew? And the Mishnah says in the first paragraph of Avos, Yehiu Aniyim B'nei Veischa, that if a person has a certain limited amount of funds, he should rather use that money to be Mefarnes Aniyei Yisrael. Right? B'nei Veischa, I mean Jewish people who are in need. We should always have a first priority to give to Jewish charities, to the community chest that is going to support Jews. Why should I use that money, says Rabbi, to buy an Eved Kanani? And Rava obviously wanted to achieve and implement this dictum of the Mishnah that let's give preference to a Jew. And Rava may have been hinting that if I'm already going to invest in buying an Eved, if I have that money, I would rather buy an Eved Ivri than an Eved Kanani. But also Lakami to Rav Papa Bar Shmuel. And Rav Papa Bar Shmuel was a potential buyer. The Eved came to him and said, Zavne, buy me. Rav Papa was not as careful as Rava was about giving Parnosa to a Jew, and therefore he went ahead and he bought the Eved. But Yom Achad Amar Leh, on one particular day, Rav Papa said to the Eved, Ashkiein Maya, can you bring me a cup of tea? Azal chavre lereshe uladikne. What he did was he returned his hair to the natural color, removing the dye from his hair, and he appeared as he really, you know, accurately is, an old man with white hairs in his head and his beard. And by washing off the dye and returning his hair to what it was, Omar Leh, the Eved says to Rav Papa, Chazi da'ano kashish me'avuch, look at me and you'll see that I'm older than your father, and therefore you have to respect me, and you can't use me as your Eved. And when Rav Papa realized that, you know, Rava was more frum than he was, Kari Anafshi, he said about himself in comparison to Rava, Sadik Mitzora Mechlatz Vayovo Acher Tachtov, that I was the Acher Tachtov, meaning Rav Papa says that the first part of this statement is Sadik Mitzora Mechlatz. I don't think this is a pasuk as far as I know. Let me just get back to you if I made a mistake on that. Oh yeah, it is a pasuk. My mistake. It's a pasuk in Mishlei, and that I see here in the Torah. Or Mishlei Yudalef, it says Sadik Mitzora Nechlatz Vayovo Rosh Hatatov. So that if Hashem, you know, saved the tzaddik from a tzara, investing a lot of money in buying an eved who can't even bring him a cup of tea because he's an alta eved, I came to replace him, so to speak. And I got stuck with it because I wasn't a tzaddik. I should have also fulfilled the dictum of the Mishnah in Avos of Yubei Aniyim B'nei Veischa. The Marashah explains that what does it mean when the pasuk says that tzaddik mitzora nechlatz, that Rav Papa Shina Lashon HaKosvi actually changed slightly the language of the verse. It says in the pasuk Vayavo Rasha Tachtov. He changes it here. If you take a look, to Vayavo Acher Tachtov, he didn't want to say about himself that I'm a Rasha, so he had to change the wording of the pasuk, because the Mishnah says Al Tehi Rasha Bifnei Atzmecha. You know, first one says about himself he's a Rasha. That itself is Lashon Hara. The Maharsha explains that in the dialogue between the Eved and Rav Papa, when the Eved said to Rav Papa, "Buy me." And then when he, after the sale, he said to him, well, the Eved says to him, well, I'm older than your father, so you have to respect me. Now this is interesting, because Vadarta Pnei Zaken L'chora is a mitzvah to be mechabit a Jew, an elderly Jew, or a scholar. But the Gemara says in Kiddushin on Daf Lamed Gimel, says the Maharsha, about Rabbi Yochanan, that he would stand up even for Zaken Armoy, meaning an older non-Jew, and he gave him covet. And therefore, the Eved was absolutely right when he said to Rav Papa, you should be mechabit me and not be mishtamish with me. Even this kind of shimush kal, it's not such a radical thing, you know, to bring him a cup of water. Hadron Alecha Perek Azov. And as an introduction to Perek Ezu Neshech, which is the fifth Perek of Metzia, let me offer a little bit of a background here. I don't think we'll have time to actually learn the Mishnah in depth, but at least to set some of the rules, the entire Perek here is dedicated to the Isur of Rivets. And in fact, the Torah uses two different terms for ribbis. One is ribbis, and one word is neshech, and the other word is tarbis. Tarbis is miloshen ribbis, but neshech means literally biting. And our Mishnah is going to address the question of Ezu Neshev, Ezu Tarvis, meaning what's the difference between the two. And this is based on the Pasuk Vayikra Chaf Hei, Pasuk Lamed Vav, where the Torah says Neshech V'Tarvis. And the question is, what's the difference between Neshech, which means bite, something that bites, because the, you know, the Loveh, since he's paying extra money, so that's called neshech, that extra money is biting into him. And tarbis comes from the word rava, which means to increase. And here the lova is increasing the assets of the lender, of the malva. And the word marbis, which is used by the Torah, or tarbis, is a word that's used to indicate usury or interest. And in the Mishnah they use the word ribis, which is again tarbis, marbis, ribis are all derived from the same shoresh. And the Mishnah wants to discuss at the very beginning of this perek why does the Torah use two terms? Are there certain kinds of ribis, of transactions, that are neshech, and other types that's ribis? Ezu neshech ve'ezu tarbis. But just to offer a little bit of an introduction as to why the Torah allows you to take interest from a non-Jew but not from a Jew, which sounds like, you know, we're not being politically correct. But what we really have to understand is that, and many people make this mistake, there's nothing absolutely wrong with taking ribbits. You know, if a person ties up his money, he has a right to be paid for that service. And the Torah is very machmir here with the five different lavim in the Torah repeating itself over and over again about charging ribbis. And it, as we said before, it seems ethically reasonable to offer the borrower to pay ribis. The borrower is, from his own perspective, more than happy to pay that ribis. He realizes that out there in the market, when you borrow money, you've got to pay some sort of interest, and that's a fair request. In essence, the Torah is offering with a great chesed towards the loaver a free interest loan. And that's not to indicate that there's something absolutely unethical about charging ribis. You know, the victim of ribis, which is the loaf, is more than willing. He consents to suffering this interest. So why, you know, it's not like Zela where, you know, if somebody steals something from him. Here, the interest really is something that, as we said before, the borrower would be more than happy to pay. But rather, this is a religious obligation within the context of creating a family and a clan and a brotherhood amongst the Jewish people. The Torah says that our first responsibility of chesed is vis-a-vis our own, you know, the members of Klal Yisrael, Knesset Yisrael, part of our shvatim. And therefore, there's a special level of higher, you know, a special demand of a higher moral, ethical conduct with regard to fellow Jews. And as far as Goyim is concerned, we go back to what's fair. And what's fair is, you know, we're not allowed to steal from a Goyim, but we're allowed to charge in ribis. And it's very fascinating. And this is pointed out by Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky, Zichrono Livracha, that when you look in Shulchan Aruch, you know, you have two out of the four branches or Chalokim in Shulchan Aruch, you have two out of the four, Yoredeya and Choshen Mishpat. The laws of Dinei Momonos are included in Choshen Mishpat. We would have anticipated, I think, if I would ask you where would the laws of Ribis be, would there be in Yoredeya, which is more the ritual concepts of Isur V'Heter, or Choshen Mishpat, which is Dinei Momonos, you would anticipate that this is a Momon Halacha. But the answer is that if you open up the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch, you'll find that they codify the laws of interest in Yoredeya, not in Choshen Mishpat. And that's to demonstrate that these laws are not some sort of financial exploitation that belong to Choshen Mishpat, but rather this higher level of Bein Odom LaMakom, to express a kind of a love for a fellow Jew. Now, it's very interesting. The fundamental difference between Gzela and Ribis expresses itself in the following way. Let's say, for example, Reuven lends money to Shimon at an interest rate and violates the Isur of Ribis, and now the interest was taken, in a sense, illegally against the and violating the law of Ribis. The Lova actually paid the Malva. And the Ritva in Kiddushin says that with this money, he can be Makadish and Isha. Meaning, the Malva is the legal owner of this money. Meaning, if he stole money, he can't be Makadish and Isha. He's Chayiv in the midst of Hashavas Agzeil. It's not really his. But in the case of Ribis, the money is actually his. And in the case of Gzela, if the Gazlan dies, then his Yarshim have to pay back the Gzela because it doesn't belong to them. But in the case of Ribis, there may be a halach of Kibud Av, you know, to honor the memory and the reputation of one's late father, but technically the Yarshim have no chiyuv to return the ribis because it's rightfully the owner of their father who took the ribis, even though there was a violation involved. Now, there's something called ribis ktsutza and there's avak ribis. So one category of ribis is doraisa, the other is drabana. The only kind of ribis which is doraisa is ribis ktsutza, where the agreement to pay X amount of ribis was signed and sealed, so to speak, at the time of the loan. In which case the Reuven says to Shimon, I'll lend you the money, but you have to pay me interest. That's doraisa. But in the case of Durabana, which is called Avak Ribis, the Lova is giving to the Malva something above and beyond the value that he received from the Malva, but it wasn't Ketsutza, it was never arranged at the time of the loan. Now, we're going to also have to talk about something called Psikala Peros and Sa Besa and Heter Iska, and basically all transactions today that have some sort of shmek of ribis into it, they all are going to be permissible based on Heter Iska, which means that instead of the Lova paying extra money to the Malva for the loan, they both become partners in some sort of an investment. So that if I lend, so to speak, the bank money by depositing money, the bank tells me that we are going to invest that money and we'll share the dividends. And it's basically an investment of two partners. And that's an arrangement that has to be written up by posek, according to the halachic specifications, in order to allow the bank to pay the I call it the malva, meaning the person who deposited the money in the bank. There are other kinds of cases that also fit into problems of ribis in contemporary life. You have something called an installment plan, which means if you pay up front, then you get saved a certain surcharge, right? A surcharge is a charge that is usually added because the buyer is not paying up front, and the buyer who pays up front is going to be exempt from paying these surcharges. So by allowing allowing the seller to get the money up front, he is giving his money over to the seller, like a malva gives to the loaf, and he's getting a discount for that. He's getting a free, he's getting freed of what otherwise would be a surcharge. And these kinds of discounts that are offered for advance payments are so common. Now, in terms of those who involve in dealings of currency, that's a problem of sub besar, because currency goes up and down, as we know. I mean, the people who check their internet every day to find out the value of the shekel, the dollar, or the yen, or whatever currency we're talking about. So these fluctuate, and that's called sub besar. So let's say I borrow a dozen eggs from you, and you expect me to return a dozen eggs a week later. In the meantime, eggs went up in price. Okay, that's not so common, because there's not that much of a fluctuation of the market value of the eggs, within a short period of time. There's something called psikal aperos, and then we're talking about, there's a fixed price that applied to these peros, and it's not going to change. That avoids the isur d'rabbanan of ribis of sa b'sa. In any event, business transactions commonly in contemporary life involve violations of ribis, and it's very important to make sure that there's a heter iska in order to circumvent any problems of ribis. So, Yerushalayim Rav Osef Lineder will start the perek in the next shiur. And for the time being, we say goodbye to Perek HaZav. It's been a pleasure to learn Perek HaZav. I want to, at this point, express my wishes for an Ili Neshama to a Kadosh, my Chavrusa, Rav Moshe Tversky, Zichron Levracha, who learned Perek HaZav with me, and I have such fond memories of learning with him. He had an uncanny ability to learn the Pshat in a deep way, to get right down to the problem without hesitation. It would take other people hours and hours. He cut the chase right down to the yesod, right down to the fundamental issues without hesitation. And I remember that period of time when we learned Hazav together very fondly. Yiratzon, Hashem should allow us and strengthen us to continue learning Masechta Bava Metzia and Perek HaZav. You know, as difficult as it was, and there was a lot of Zeraim in Perek HaZav, a lot of Meiser Shady, and so forth, but Perek Hezu Neshech is that much more challenging. And I know that there are Bachrim in Yeshiva who, after they finished Perek Hezu Neshech over the course of an entire winter's man, they came back and said, we have to go over it again, take it from the top. Thank you so much.